What do you know about gold, Moneypenny?
Oh, the only gold I know is the kind you wear, you know, on the third finger of your left hand.
One of these days we really must look into that.
What about tonight? You'll come over for dinner and I'll cook you a wonderful angel cake.
Well, nothing would give me greater pleasure, but unfortunately I do have a business appointment.
That's the flimsiest excuse you've ever given me. Oh well, some girls have all the luck. Who is she, James?
She is me, Miss Moneypenny, and kindly omit the customary byplay with 007. We've all got a podcast to record. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thanks for joining me again this week. As you all know by now, listeners, I mean, normally we major in classic Hollywood on the Movie Palace, but today we're talking about a British cultural icon. His name? Bond. James Bond. That's right, we're talking all about the third James Bond adventure today, Goldfinger, and I'm delighted to be joined by 002 special guests on this episode. First of all, Mr. Tony Black. How's it going, Tony?
Goldfinger! Very well. That's just my Shirley Bassey there, bust there for you. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be talking about the big man, Big JB.
I only realised the other day that it's actually been, it's the first time this year we're talking together on this podcast, isn't it? It's been a while. Mm. Mary Poppins was last time, I think.
Mary Poppins. You know, every time I find an excuse to sing, so, you know, expect more of it in this episode.
That's true, I think. Yeah, Night and Hunter, we sang Singing in the Rain. Yep, definitely. And returning to the podcast for the second time, I'm delighted to welcome Gabriella Masson. Hi, Gabriella.
Hi, Carl.
How are you today, Gabriella? So Rebecca was the last time we spoke, wasn't it? Back in January, February?
Yes, I think it was. Sorry, the year is blurring into one, but I think you're right on that one. Yeah, I'm very happy to be back. Thank you for having me. But Tony beat me to the singing. I was going to belt out, but
I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's fine. I'll let
I'm sure you go. Have a better voice than me, to be fair. So you should just do it.
No, I've got stage fright.
I was wondering, Tony, how Sean Connery would say Gabriella's surname. So Masson, how would he say that?
Well, Carl, I think it would be Masson.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds about right.
See, anyone could probably do that. Like, it's one of the easiest things. If you just get the shh, like, you know, it's easy. It's easy. You know, that was a walk in the park.
Do you know what I think of your Connery impression, Tony, in a word?
Shocking.
Positively shocking.
I was waiting for that one.
Very good.
All right, guys. So we're here to discuss James Bond and, I mean, Goldfinger specifically, but I guess we have to touch on and talk about the broader phenomenon, really. And I'll just say up front that there are very few pop culture franchises that I would actually consider myself a fan of properly. So Tony would know, and some listeners will know, that The X-Files on TV would be one. And James Bond's probably the other one, to be fair. So, and it seems to me like you guys are big fans too. So I thought we should kick off by talking about our Bond fandom and just kind of the backstory, really, for all of us. So how did you get into James Bond? And why does it appeal to you in the way that it does? So, yeah, Tony, you take it away first. When did you become a fan of James Bond?
Oh, I was very young. I was born in 1982. So obviously, really, you probably shouldn't be watching Bond movies till you're about, I'd say, at least 10 years old. And maybe even that's a little bit too young, because even the older ones are a little bit racy and a little bit naughty in places and quite violent. But, you know, it was different back then. It was different in the 80s and 90s. You know, your parents didn't care. They weren't watching what you were watching. There was no parental... Well, there was a bit of parental guidance. But anyway, Bond movies weren't considered... And I'm not sure they even are anymore either, but they weren't considered too bad. So I was watching them when I was young, you know, and they were always on TV in the 90s. In the UK, ITV is one of the main channels, and they constantly had Bond on every Sunday, without doubt, every bank holiday.
Yeah.
So it was those, and then when I was watching them on TV, particularly the Roger Moore era Bonds, really. Those are the ones that, I know we're talking about Goldfinger today, but it was the Roger Moore era Bonds when I, on TV that really hooked me, and I loved all the escapism and the gadgets and all the kind of things that a young boy would love about it. And then my first cinematic Bond was GoldenEye in 1995. So I was a fan of the Brosnan era. The Brosnan era was my first cinematic Bond, and by then I was like in my mid-teens. I've just always loved it. You know, I've loved every iteration of it. I never not enjoy a Bond film. You know, it doesn't matter how good or bad it is. Well, actually, tell a lie. I don't enjoy The Man with the Golden Gun, because that's rubbish. But apart from that, I think I've enjoyed pretty much all of them. But, you know, it's just one of those sort of, and it might be a similar story for you, Carl, I don't know, but one of those sort of childhood things that has just imprinted on me. Much like The X-Files, as you said, you know, I'm a big fan of that as well. They when they imprint on you as a young boy or a young girl, they stay with you until you're a, you know, middle-aged man, as I'm rapidly approaching, who is it's sitting in my lounge looking at the biggest poster on the wall framed, which is Connery in From Russia With Love, and the poster for that. So, you know, that's how far it extends now into my life, that my wife has let me put it up in our living room, which is pretty cool, actually.
Fair play. So, yeah, I'm very similar to you. I mean, I'm a few years younger. I was born in 86. So my Bond fandom, I guess it was forged, I'm going to say, in the years between 1997 and 2002, because a lot of things happened in those 5 years. So Tomorrow Never Dies was my first Bond at the cinema. Mm. My dad took me to see that. I think that was out about the same time as Titanic, I seem to remember.
97, same Christmas, I think, 97, yeah.
Yeah, but that was also the same year that the GoldenEye Nintendo 64 computer game came out, which I loved. Brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah, I loved it.
Then, you know, they came thick and fast in those days, because The World Is Not Enough was 99, I think. It was around about that time I got a DVD box set. It was like this silver tin. I've still got it.
I remember that. My brother had that, I think, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. And then, so Die Another Day in 2002. So, yeah, my dad took me to see all of those. And somewhere in those years, I sat down and read all the Fleming books, I think, or most of them at least. So, yeah, I've been a fan ever since, but I think those were kind of the key years that sort of sealed the deal. Like, it'll never leave me because of that period where it was cemented, I think. Mm. So, Gabriella, what about you? Am I right in thinking, I don't know how old you are exactly, but I've got a feeling you're quite a bit younger than us.
I was born in 1992.
Okay.
But talking about parental sort of control, the first movie I saw at the cinema in about 1996 when I was about four was GoldenEye. Don't ask me how they let us in. you know, things have always been a little bit lax here, I must admit. It was sort of like, you know, I've gone to some movies these days and I thought, geez, there shouldn't be a kid in here. But there you go, you know, it seems to have carried on. And my mom said that she was amazed that I sat through this whole movie, didn't move a muscle, thought it was amazing. Obviously, the finer points of the plot went completely over my head. But she said to me that at the end of the movie, I saw it wildly clapping. She said she was like, wow, you know, because she loved Bond. I mean, if you don't love Bond on my mother's side of the family, you better not be part of the family. Kind of thing. Just get out. Yeah, I mean, talking about you having a poster, Tony, behind me is the poster for License to Kill. It's on my door in my bedroom.
Oh, cool. That's a great one, that is.
So that's my favorite Bond movie. But yeah, and then from that point onwards, I mean, we had all of them on tape. Then my mom got them on DVD eventually. I watched, I don't even know how many times I've watched each of them. The only Bond that I can't really stomach is On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I know that a lot of people are going to be booing me right now. I don't think Lazenby was.
Boo.
Yeah, I thought so. I just don't like Lazenby as Bond. Pretty much like everything else in that movie, but Lazenby just gives me a cramp. Like, I just cannot watch that movie. Now when the 50th anniversary came out, I bought the Blu-ray special edition box sets. Yeah. I've got all of them. I'm such a completionist that I even have Never Say Never Again, even though that's not even Eon production. I have that one because I'm just like, I have to have every single one that Bond is even remotely in. And I've read most of the books. Funny enough, though, my favorite Bond book is not actually one written by Fleming. It's Devil May Care. I can't remember the author's name now. A Bond continuation book.
Where
the villain has a monkey's paw. I don't know. That just appeals to me. I just think it's cool. I've read it quite a few times. But if I had to say which Fleming book is my favorite, it's probably Thunderball. I really like that. He's very like witty. The quips are really good in that one. And I just really like the setup in that book. I like the movie too, but the underwater sequences just kill me. They're just so long.
Yeah, I really like a couple of the early books. Like the first one, Casino Royale, I really like. And I really like Moonraker, which is about as far from the film adaptation as you can imagine. But
I know, yeah, I remember.
Okay, so in terms of what the appeal was for me, I was trying to think back to the late 90s. And I don't know, just the general sense of adventure, I guess. The hair-raising escapes, the music. I think The Beautiful Women was part of it too, to be fair.
Yeah,
just it was kind of this sense of discovery to the whole thing, but not in a way that was overwhelming. So at that time, there were just under 20 films to watch. So, you know, it was doable, it seemed like. So, like, I've never been into things like Star Trek, what Tony likes, just because it seems overwhelming. But Bond seemed achievable to get to grips with. But I was wondering about the cultural, and like Tony's alluded to, really, the generational component to this, because I think for a lot of viewers in the 60s and 70s and beyond, these films served as like a window to the world for audiences who couldn't travel much. So
yes.
I think the appeal of seeing like Jamaica in Dr. No, for instance, or the locales in Thunderball must have been considerable. I don't know about you, Tony. When I think back to my childhood, I mean, we did go to some nice places, but there was a fair amount of like Butlin's holiday camps and things like that. So growing up, there was still a sense of escapism to these Bond films. Is that kind of how you saw it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I grew up in a fairly working class British family, and we didn't go abroad. You know, I didn't go abroad till I was in my 20s without my family. So, yeah, going to a Bond movie was like going on holiday, you know, going on an exotic holiday when you're in the movies, you know, and you're watching Brosnan's Bond in Cuba and all these places. You know, there is a real glamour to it. I mean, that was something that was particularly acute, I think, back in the 60s for... Yeah. Families then, you know, and for young people then, in that it really did transport them into these different worlds in a way that movies and TV just hadn't done in that, you know, in that kind of way, and with that sense of class and style. And that, you know, that's something that bleeds through all the movies right up until the present day, you know, right up until recently, until Spectre. So you do always feel with Bond that you're being transported into a world of this kind of dark elegance with all these exotic places that then people go and try and go to. I got married last year. On our honeymoon, we went to Phuket in Thailand. And unfortunately, because of the fact it was monsoon season, we couldn't do this. And as much as I say I don't like The Man with the Golden Gun, we did try and go to James Bond Island, which was nearby, which was where they, on the beach, they have he and Scaramanga have the big, you know, stuff going on. And we tried to go to that location, but we couldn't. I know for a fact there's people I know who because it's this weekend we're recording, it is the anniversary of 50 years of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And there are people I know at the top of Pitt's Gloria right now, taking pictures and, you know, all that stuff. So it stays with you. And I don't think there's any other franchise where you actively go and you get excited at the thought of going to these locations and seeing these locations and these spectacles, really.
Yeah, and I'm curious about this from your perspective, Gabriella, because, I mean, Tony's alluded to this already, but the Bond films have had this cultural status in the UK.
Yeah.
Where it's like you said, they were always shown on Bank Holiday Mondays, it seemed, always on over Christmas. Whenever there was a TV premiere of like the latest film, it would draw big audiences.
Yeah.
So it was like, even if you didn't like them, they had a presence that I think was difficult to avoid. So I'm just kind of curious about how that, you know, how that's been in your country. Because I know you've said that your mum liked it, but does it have this wider status?
Well, firstly, my mother is, her side of the family is British and Cornish and Welsh. So it's like, you know, obviously. But yes, it does have a cultural resonance here. I mean, a lot of the white population here are Afrikaans. So they're not English speakers. And they still know who James Bond is. The majority of people living here in South Africa are, of course, black South Africans. They know who Bond is. They go and see the movies. It maybe doesn't resonate as much with them, but they still know who James Bond is, you know, if you mention him and stuff. And we actually, I think it was about 2 years ago, we have it's like a cable network channel, I suppose people would call it. It's called DSTV here. And we had a pop-up channel that showed all of the Bond films. And, you know, like I actually had a few people who were at work who were saying to me, you know, Are you watching the James Bond pop-up channel? And I was like, obviously. I mean, I love Bond. And we were all watching it. So it does. It really resonates. It's just, it seems to be like a global thing. And like, as you said, for me, it's still a thing of escaping and seeing new locations. Because I've traveled all over South Africa, but I've only been to Mauritius. That's the only place I've been to overseas because my dad comes from there. And I haven't been to Europe. So, or obviously the East or anything like that. So every time I watch a Bond film, I think, you know, this is like a window for me. I feel like I'm traveling with him. I feel like I'm in his suitcase, you know. I'm on the mission with him. And it's just this, as you say, this beautiful thing of escapism, and there's danger, and there are beautiful women. Not all of them, you know, like I like. Some of them irritate me, like Christmas Jones. Oh my God, I didn't even know what they were thinking of that one. But like with Goldfinger, I mean, you know, I love Honor Blackman. She is amazing. Yeah. She's in my top five. My favorite Bond girl's Aki from You Only Live Twice. Yeah, it's just a sense of like, you know, it's, I mean, even my nephew, who's only 9 now, he watched a few of the Bonds with me a few years ago. Obviously, I sort of like fast-forwarded through the violent bits because, he couldn't really watch that. He was saying, he was like, it's too violent. I was like, okay, yeah, I'll go through the bit, you know. But yeah, he watched it with me. So I'm trying to get it in there as well with him.
Yeah, so before we move on, I mean, I'll just say that these films have been very meaningful to me in a weird sort of way, and it's funny that we've already dissed The Man with a Golden Gun, because I agree with Tony, I don't think it's very good either, but The Man with a Golden Gun is also responsible for one of the happiest moments of my life, I would say. So I'm going to take you guys back to October 2015. So my daughter was born on the 25th of October. My birthday was the following day, 26th of October, also the same day that Spectre was released.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I couldn't get to see Spectre for a day or two later because I was, you know, making sure things were going well at home. But that first night, Georgia was home and I was looking after her so her mum could get some sleep. So I had her kind of led on me and I sat there and watched The Man with a Golden Gun whilst I was looking after her. And I don't really think it's a very good film, you know, but the Bond films just got this thing with me. I can happily watch any of them, I think. And I just remember I had this feeling wave over me, like total bliss, you know. Then I saw Spectre. I took my son to see Spectre a day or two later, the first Bond film he saw at the cinema. But he's just not that into them, you know. I mean, things have changed so much, I think, in this country since I was a kid. You know, just ever cheaper air travel, mobile telephones, the growth of the internet, so much more to watch, you know. But I just don't know if these films mean the same things to younger kids anymore. Now they've got the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Star Wars churning films out and stuff. He doesn't really care about Bond 25. And I don't know. Is it a problem, Tony, for Bond, for the franchise, this kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. I think it's something they're increasingly going to face as their audiences get older and older. I think they'll be all right for a while. I think, you know, the most of us who loved it as a kid and our dads or our parents loved it and things like that, you know, we're not old enough yet to stop going to the cinema and, you know, touch wood, not dying off yet. So there's a while to go. For our generation, I think, you know, 30s... And, you know, obviously, Gabriella, you're in your 20s, so it's like, you know, it's not just the older people necessarily. But on the whole, I think you'll find that most of the core Bond fans are probably 30-something plus now. So there's still a while. But I think for the franchise to really resonate with younger people, with people under maybe 20 years old now, I think they would be wise post-Daniel Craig to maybe... And this is something I don't know if they will ever do, but maybe start thinking about a bit of a broader canvas for this character and not just making Bond younger, but I think exploring the idea of bringing Bond into the way they make films these days, like they make the Marvel Universe, like they make the Star Wars Universe, and actually creating a bit more of a Bond cinematic universe. You know, I think realistically they're going to have to change the way they make these films to keep them relevant and resonant to young people, because while they are unique still, I think it is a bit of a dying breed. And I don't know how much longer it can last to have that pop cultural impact amongst people, especially younger people.
Mm. So what are you thinking about that, Gabriella, and also about Bond 25? Because for me as a Bond fan these days, a lot of it is about, you know, the anticipation and the speculation around each upcoming film, you know. Mm-hmm. Then it's released and we go and watch it. And then there's this process where it kind of settles into the canon and it takes its rightful place, and we work out how much we like it or not, you know. Yeah. So what about this upcoming film? Because it's been a long time in the works. Like I say, 2015 since Spectre. It's been a troubled production in some ways. Danny Boyle was going to direct until he wasn't. Mm-hmm. The release date slipped a couple of times, I think. And then there's this report of Daniel Craig being injured and all this. So I feel like you're following the production more closely than I am, because I've seen you commenting on it on Twitter and stuff. So hopes and expectations for Bond 25?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with Tony that growing on after Daniel Craig, they are going to have a younger Bond. I'm hoping it's going to be Aidan Turner. I think that he is, like, tailor-made for that role. You know, the problem is that with Bond 25, I'm really worried because I'm getting, like, A View to a Kill vibes off of it. I'm like, please, God. You know, Daniel Craig isn't a spring chicken anymore. He still looks great. I mean, you can't compare him to Roger Moore. In A View to a Kill. I mean, I loved Roger. He was my childhood Bond. I mean, I loved him when I was a kid. But, you know, when you get older and you watch A View to a Kill, you're like, I love you, Rog, but you're not only long in the tooth, you're long in the tusk in that movie. I mean, it's like, he looks like he's romancing his daughter. So I'm just really worried about, like, Daniel Craig kind of looking like that a little bit, even though he's really physically, like, in great shape. But, yeah, I mean, the thing is that people are getting more and more frustrated by the fact that they have to wait, because they're saying, but we don't have to wait for movies like John Wick and Mission Impossible, which actually are made on a pretty much a similar scale and have similar characters in them, you know? So people, as you say, it's less of a sort of loyalty thing that's going on now, and it's more people saying, well, I just really want you to make a good film. They can't really bank on the fact that it's Bond as much anymore. They, like, really just have to keep up, as you guys were saying. So it's worrying because, as you say, nah, it's supposed to be Daniel Craig's last film, and I hope it's going to be good for him because he's my favorite Bond after Dalton and Connery. I think he's really brought a lot to the films. But yeah, I don't know. Like, we'll see who's going to play, who's going to do the theme song as well. Because I was actually joking with someone on Twitter the other day, and we were saying, geez, you know, like, who's going to be the Duran Duran to Daniel Craig's Bond? And I was like, maybe Imagine Dragons, or, you know, like Florence the Machine or something, you know. I wouldn't actually have a problem with Florence the Machine doing it because she's got an amazing voice. But yeah, they have to be careful with this one because they're on a slippery slope.
I just hope it's a fitting swan song to his run, really, because I think he's been in two Stone Cold classics, in my view, in Skyfall and Casino Royale, so he deserves to go out on a high.
I think Gabriella speaks a lot of truth there. I think there are some dangers with it. I think it will be fine. I think it will be probably roughly on a par with Spectre. I like Spectre.
I do too.
Yeah. I enjoy it, and I think it's a lot of fun. It's not nearly as good as Skyfall or particularly Casino Royale, which I think is the best Daniel Craig Bond still. But I think they have reached a point with this iteration of Bond, in that now it constantly feels like they're kind of chasing their tail with this now. It feels like they're constantly on the back foot, whether it's, you know, scripts that aren't quite working, production factors getting in the way, you know, schedules, all this kind of thing. The fact that Daniel Craig is kind of reminiscent of Connery, I think, in that I think he's always going to struggle with this. You know, some Bonds, they really take to it. Like, Roger Moore loved the fact he was James Bond, and he played up to it all his life. Pierce Brosnan does to an extent as well, I think. I think he's quite content in it. I think Dalton always feels like he wishes he'd had more, to be honest, especially now. But I think Daniel Craig wants to be thought of as more than just James Bond, like Sean Connery has always felt that way. And I think you'll find that Craig will be much more reticent to talk about it and be much less comfortable about it as time goes on. So it's one of those things where I think now they need to just give him a sign-off, wrap it all up, put this era to bed as best they can, because they've retconned a lot. They've jigged things around to sort of fit and awkwardly seem like they are part of a continuity, which doesn't really work. And then start again and really start to think about this in creating a new era for Bond that does feel more contemporary and does keep the glamour and the class of the previous, you know, eras, but make it a little bit more of a modern approach, and also not get bogged down in all the production problems, which really, I mean, we've had, in 15 years, we've had 4 James Bond films. Now, I don't think that's enough by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I think it's way too few. And I think they need to start rethinking about how they make them, because I think they're making them in a very traditional, very fixed, unique way. And I think that Bond 25, from what I'm hearing, is going to end up a bit like, oh, thank God it's done. Let's start thinking about the next one, you know?
Yeah, well, I agree with a lot of what you guys said. I think they need to retool the machine post-Craig and stuff. But what I propose is that we, when it comes out, I reckon we come back, we discuss Thunderball or something, but we use it as a stealth discussion of Bond 25. You know, we get back into these things.
Sounds good.
But yeah, Goldfinger. So Connery's third Bond, the third Bond film made. Just general thoughts, really, because, I mean, for me, Goldfinger is one of my favourites of the series, I must say. I think it's really good. And I think it's so good because it features so many iconic elements, which we're going to discuss.
Yeah.
It kind of points the way forward for the series in a lot of ways. I think it's aged very well in many respects. Not all, perhaps, but it's a very stylish film. So as kind of a pop culture artifact of the 1960s, I think it's a notable one. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Gabriella, general thoughts on Goldfinger?
Well, it's definitely in my top five. As I said, my two favourites are License to Kill and You Only Live Twice. I don't know. Those two just really resonate with me. But funny enough, I actually went to visit my brother today, and I was saying to him, I'm going to be on Carl's podcast, and we're going to talk about Goldfinger with Tony. And he was like, oh my God, that is my favourite one. I love that one so much. Like, he was just, like, so blissful that we were going to talk about it, you know. And I agree with you in saying that it's aged really well. I mean, when I was watching it yesterday, I was just so happy. I was like, oh, this is so good. You know, I just, every 5 minutes I was thinking in my head, oh, that's a good part. And, oh, this is so good. And, oh, Connery is really... Because what I love about Goldfinger is, firstly, it's the first one to have the theme song. Shirley Bassey's belting her lungs out. I mean, she said that she really struggled with that song, but then she got her breathing controlled, and she said it was just awesome. She says she's like one of the best achievements vocally for her, and I agree with her. And as you say, it's just so many elements come to place. It's almost like Dr. No and From Russia with Love have been the dress rehearsals, even though they're really good Bonds, but they've been like the dress rehearsal for Goldfinger. And then Goldfinger comes, and you're just like, the way the movie starts with the Goldfinger theme, like instrumental, and they go to the Miami Beach, and Sean Connery is just, he's becoming Bond. Felix is there. You've got the first villain who, like, really has come up with this, like, world domination, mwahahaha plan, you know? Like, and he's... His name's Goldfinger. I mean, God, that's like, if that is not a Bond villain name, then I don't know what is. And it's, yeah, just everything falls into place. And it's just, it is a classic. It is definitely like one of the best in the series. And as you say, it still holds up really well. But you say, there's a few things in it, like when he end up, the fact that her name is Pussy Galore, I mean, you know, no subtlety there, but meh. And also when they first kiss each other and they're like, you know, what I love about that part is that Pussy is like whacking him around and everything, but he does kind of force himself on her, and you're like, and she kind of just suddenly gives in, and then you think because he's given her a good time, you know, in the hay, that's why she swaps the canisters. So that's a bit of an issue.
Yeah, it is interesting because she's kind of fighting him off, like you say, and the score, it's like this romantic score that swells up. It's kind of very strange. Like, we'll come back to some of these issues. What's your sense, Tony? Because I think Gabrielle's right, isn't she? But in terms of its significance in the Bond series, you know, it comes after Dr. No and From Russia with Love. And I really like both of those films, actually. It feels like they contain many of the things we'd regard as quintessentially Bond, but they're not necessarily presented in the manner we then come to expect, if that makes sense. So I guess a large part of the significance for Goldfinger is, does it kind of perfect the basic Bond formula, do you think? And then from Thunderball onwards, the films largely repeat that framework, it seems. Occasionally you get a different spin on things. You know, occasionally they adapt something or subvert it, but largely they stick to the formula. Is that how you see it too?
Yeah, and so did Guy Hamilton, who directed it. I'd just like to quote what he says here. He said previously that they were helped naturally by what had come before. Terence Young, who directed the first two films, had understood a lot of things from the audience reaction of Dr. No. Sean Connery matured rapidly, and the difference between No and Russia is vast. Myself, Sean and the team, we all knew what we were aiming for. Bond was sweetened, I suppose, by the perfection of formula. And that's it. That's exactly what you've just said. Formula is here. This is the first Bond film that they then essentially remake for the next 20, 30 years, basically. You know, Goldfinger's got all of the composite elements. It's got the villain with the ridiculous plan who has delusions of grandeur and the base and all this kind of thing. It's got, and Dr. No did have that, to be fair. So there's also a lot of the DNA in Dr. No in the character and that setup, but it didn't have it in how the film was structured. You've also got the Bond girl You've got the femme fatale. You've got the girl who he's disposed of early. You've got the henchman, you know, and you've got the ultimate, the structure of the story, which is essentially the instigating sort of mission, Bond investigating, gets captured, has to escape, takes down the villain. And that's, in many ways, for most of the movies, that's kind of the template that follows, really. And it only sort of, it sort of undulates and fluctuates since then. And the reason that it does that, most of the films, is that it's a really good formula. It's a really good, entertaining formula that allows the plot and the narrative to rattle along. It allows all the, it allows Goldfinger to be more breezy. I mean, one of the criticisms I've always had of Goldfinger, and I will be, I'm going through and writing about the Bonds over the next year, and I'm, From Russia With Love is my next one, so Goldfinger's not far away. And one thing that I'm looking forward to exploring again is that I've always felt like Connery sort of just glides through Goldfinger. Bond never really feels in particular jeopardy. Whereas in, specifically in From Russia With Love, you really sort of get the sense that he could, like, maybe not die, but that he's in real peril at points. And I never get that feeling with Goldfinger, but the, it doesn't matter. It's almost like he, this is the film that elevates him to a superhero, basically. Mm. And I think Bond being a superhero is part of the point. And, you know, it's certainly, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but it fits the era that, that this was made in the early 1960s. That's what people wanted. They wanted this escapism. They wanted this larger-than-life hero fighting these larger-than-life villains. Like, like people were reading in comic books, you know, they were reading Marvel, you know, and that kind of thing. Bond isn't really that different. It's just a different medium and a different style. And I think you could, in fact, you could quite easily just probably put a lot of this into a comic book of the time, and it would work, actually, in many ways. So I think the formula is precisely what this nails. And whether or not it was intentional or just by pure luck and happenstance, I don't know. But I think the alchemy clicks here, and then they keep going with it. And it, and it's what makes Bond so lovable over the years.
Yeah, so it's really interesting, all these things we're talking about, because just a couple of comments. So I just noticed earlier on Twitter that friend of the podcast, Darren Mooney, I think he's been watching the X-Men films, and he made a comparison to Goldfinger, which is this. He said that Goldfinger, while brilliant in and of itself, codified a number of tropes and conventions that came to overwhelm a lot of later entries in the James Bond franchise. Just because things are good ideas in particular cases doesn't mean they're always good ideas. Mm. So I thought that's an interesting debate we could have. And then we had a comment come in on Twitter to us from Mike34, who said, "The first three films are Connery's best, but I think the problem with Goldfinger and every Bond, with a couple of exceptions, is that every Bond until Casino Royale copied the same formula. Even Connery himself said From Russia With Love is his favourite, and he didn't like Goldfinger because he's behind the plot," which is kind of what you're alluding to there, Tony, I think, with Bond not being in jeopardy, jeopardy and stuff like that. So I don't know, Gabriella, how do you see it? Because this is the kind of thing you hear people say sometimes about something like Raiders of the Lost Ark too, that, like, what would have been different if Indiana Jones hadn't been there? So in Goldfinger, I guess the line of argument would be, you know, Bond spends a, you know, spends quite a bit of time playing golf, driving around the Swiss mountains. He's reactive rather than proactive a lot of the time. He's held captive by Goldfinger for a long period. Doesn't defuse that bomb at the end of the film. But as Tony sort of says, it is like he's kind of coasting through it in some ways. He doesn't really feel, with the possible exception of the laser scene, perhaps, that he's in any real danger. But I don't know. Do you agree? And if so, do you think any of these things feel like problems or not?
I don't know. I always feel like he's in jeopardy in this movie. I mean, it doesn't matter how many times I watch it, you know. And the thing is that he doesn't know as much as he does in later films as he knows in this film. I mean, when you get to the Moore era, especially the later Moore films, he's like, "Do you know about this, 007? And he's like, "Yes, sir." And then he gives you an encyclopedia entry of something. And you're like, "How do you know that, James?" You know? I love it. But you really think, so you're like, how did you hear about that? I mean,
yeah, he's like, he can fly any plane or, you know, that kind
exactly.
Of
like, he, as you say, that's what actually I love about Goldfinger. He doesn't defuse the bomb at the end. He's like, how the fuck am I supposed to do this? Like, which wire do I pull? Oh my God. And then he drives into a wall because he doesn't recognize he's driving towards a mirror. He's genuinely scared of Oddjob. You can see he's like peeing his pants a little bit when Oddjob, like, you know, takes that statue's head off. And I do feel he's like in jeopardy in the movie because I think he actually, yeah, he is kind of behind things all the time and he's trying to catch up and he's like, you know, he is breaking a bit of a sweat, but Connery is showing that that Bond is trying to kind of still be the cool, calm agent that he's supposed to be, you know? Yeah, I do feel like he's in jeopardy. I mean, God, the fact that also the way they shot that laser scene was them having a blowtorch under the table. Obviously, it was probably a stunt double, not Connery. But that sounds dangerous still to me. God, man. You know, like, that scene is really hair-raising, in my opinion. And I love it when he goes, do you really expect me to talk, Goldfinger? And he's like, Goldfinger, and he's like, no, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. And I'm like, oh my God, it doesn't matter how many times I watch this movie. I'm still like, oh God, oh, James, poor James. I mean, and that part of his anatomy is very important to him. So he was really sweating there kind of thing, you know? And it's, I think there's a lot of tension. And then when Tilly shows up, you're like, who the hell is this girl? You know, there is mystery about it. Obviously, having seen the movie 500 times like I have, I know exactly who she is. But it's interesting that there's that element of sort of revenge that comes in with her. Bond Fs up because he's trying to kind of protect her. Like when he pulls her back and her gun goes up into the wire and they all know that he's there. This is kind of the first Bond film for me where it really feels like things are going wrong for him and he's like, oh my God, what do I do? Oh my God, what do I do? Because I don't feel like he has that problem in Dr. No and From Russia with Love as much. Like the only part in From Russia with Love where I really think, oh God, is he going to be okay, is on the train. The rest of it, I think that I feel like he's kind of coasting through From Russia with Love and then he's trying to run a marathon in Goldfinger, but that's just like my perspective. I mean,
well, we had a comment from the Two Smokes podcast, and they said Goldfinger is the most interesting Bond film because so much goes wrong for Bond.
Yes.
Seeing his headlights in the mirror, the lost homing device, etc., etc.
Exactly.
So, I mean, Tony, I guess what I was kind of thinking is one of the interesting things in the film, to an extent, I think, is there's this shadow of emasculation that hangs over Bond to an extent. So the famous scene with the laser, as Gabrielle has talked about there, yeah, always makes me, you know, cross my legs as well, but also
makes me cross mine, Cole, and I don't even have the same equipment, so yeah.
Also, you know, Oddjob, I'm thinking of the scene where Oddjob throws that bowler hat and decapitates a statue, and you see Bond kind of looking on uneasily, thinking of like Tilly Masterson almost shooting him while she stood like way above him overhead on the mountainside. Mm-hmm. Pussy galore looming over him when he wakes up. So I don't know, I know you're into like broader themes and things, so I guess in the culture generally, Western culture, dominant masculinity seems to go through these crises in the 60s and beyond, doesn't it? So, you know, the countercultural movement in the US and in the UK, traditional deference kind of breaks down to a large extent. So I wonder if it's kind of reflected in the Bond films too, but the thing is that Bond always is able to reassert himself, isn't he? So any threats to his status are overcome, the proper order is restored. So he kind of functions as this kind of male imperialist wish fulfillment fantasy figure.
I think really you only really get a level of emasculation to Bond with it to a certain extent, you know. Yeah. And I think if we're being brutally honest, that's not what audiences at the time wanted anyway, you know. And it's not even necessarily what audiences want now, you know. I mean, you only have to look at the this is a slightly different sort of debate, but you only have to look at a lot of the reaction to the idea of a Jane Bond. You know, and some of that does, you know, move into outright sexism, obviously. But there is a lot of pushback against something like that because the fundamental character of James Bond is that he is supposed to be a bit of a misogynist. You know, he is supposed to be, you know, if you go back to Ian Fleming, who was himself. I mean, Ian Fleming really is trying to write a fantasy wish fulfillment version of himself, let's be honest. Yeah. In the books, you know, he had that sort of spy life to a degree. I think that's been sort of mythologized a bit much with certain TV programs and films subsequently. I doubt he had quite the exciting life that some of those shows suggest. But he certainly lived and had that some of that glamour and some of that, you know, espionage to him. And I think he wrote a lot of that into Bond and tried to wish fulfill and had Bond facing these larger-than-life villains. So I think really, if you go back to the source material, you know, Fleming was a bit of a misogynist. He was a bit of a bigot. He was a bit of a racist, you know, and it's all there in the books. You know, you don't have to go very far to find it. And I think that is something that isn't as translated into the films as roughly or as harshly because, you know, that's not quite how it works. That's not how Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman knew they would engender Bond to people. And I think ultimately they wanted Bond to be a figure that you could root for, that you would like. And I think Goldfinger does a lot to make him, you know, inject a lot more of that intentional levity and have Connery playing off a lot more of the one-liners and things like that. So I think the emasculation is, if it's there, it's fairly coded, it's fairly subtext. Because, I mean, you only have to look at how he treats Dink. You know, that's not really, that's, you know, slaps her on the bum and says man talk. I mean, that's probably one of the most, yeah. I mean, when you look back now, it's really bad, you know, but at the time, that would have been considered funny. You know, that was a joke. That was him being, you know, Bond, you know, that kind of thing. And she just, she runs off with it. Now everyone would look back and go, oh my God, like, you know, that's awful. That's awful behavior. So I think really, I don't buy the idea that he's necessarily been too heavily emasculated here. I think if you look hard enough, you'll find something that I'm not sure is fully there, really.
Well, that's actually what I do think is that... So he's kind of a counterpoint to some of the issues that are going on in reality with masculinity at the time. You know, he's basically immune to a lot of these things.
Mm.
So it's kind of what you say, I think, Tony, that there's no getting away from the fact that these films are dated and outmoded in many ways. I mean, I know people who just won't watch them because they think they're so sexist and racist. And it's also true what you say, but if they think that, let's just hope they never read Live and Let Die, for instance.
The books are
a different thing altogether. Even though I think Fleming was a very good storyteller, to be truthful.
Mm.
All sorts of issues, but... Yeah, so it's I mean, we could level this charge at quite a few other characters in the series, but it's like Tony says, isn't it, Gabriella, you know, the scene with Dink.
Yes.
Also, the stuff we've already alluded to with Pussy Galore and, you know, this flying squad she's got as well, quite demeaning setup and things.
Yeah.
So arguably, even the idea of referring to women in the films as Bond girls is inherently a bit dismissive, you know. So how do you see that? Should it trouble us as contemporary viewers, or how do we kind of account for it?
You know, it's tough for me because in my research, I look at gender equality, gender normative behavior, like how gender is represented. And yeah, I mean, okay, Bond is troubling from a gender perspective. We cannot ignore that, as you say, especially the early films. Yeah, that part with man talk, I'm always like, don't do that, James. You know, and the funny thing is that Fleming starts writing these novels because he's afraid to get married. He was really nervous about getting married, so he starts writing James Bond, and you think to yourself, well, what are you really trying to explore? As you say, it's this masculine superhero. But the thing about James is that he is not a sexual predator, thank God. I mean, he never really feels like he's preying on the woman that he's going after. I mean, when he goes to Jill in the room, you know, he says, listen up, Goldfinger, and all that kind of stuff. But Jill is clearly interested. She's like, oh, well, he's rather nice, you know, with his lovely blue towel-y jumper looking thing. And I'm quite happy with that scene too, because Sean has the best legs, just gonna put it out there. You know, I mean, she's not like, oh no, you know, I don't want to do this kind of thing. I mean, she's enjoying herself quite a lot, and so he's not that. And yes, okay, the flying squad, what woman would wear that outfit while flying a plane? I mean, God knows. You know, those bras as well. Oh, they do not look comfortable. No, thank you. I mean, you can say I've sewn them into a point. And that one chick who gets out who looks like a Barbie. I mean, yeah, these are problematic scenes. And she's like, oh, it went like a dream, Skipper. But these women are still pilots. They still have a really indispensable skill. You know, they're not shown as being complete airheads or anything like that. And that woman in the beginning of the film is a sly bitch as well, because she's trying to get Bond killed. You know, and you think to yourself, actually, that the thing about the women in these films, in Goldfinger in particular, they're not weak. They don't just bow down to Bond and go, okay, that's fine, you know. Tilly gives him what's for. She's like, piss off the whole time. Pussy is like, you know, we can do it the easy way or the hard way. She threatens to shoot him. And as I said, she throws him around, you know, like you can't believe in that scene. And as I've already said, there's an issue with, you know, maybe he has a magic penis, where he, you know, persuades her with that or something, you know. But yeah, I never feel like Bond is really forcing himself on these women, or like making them do things that they don't want to do.
I think one of the few films I think where he maybe does cross that line. Ironically, you'd mentioned it earlier, Gabriella Rao, it's not technically sort of canon, but if there is such a thing with Bond, but Never Say Never Again in the massage parlour. I think that's where it comes close to actually stepping over the line really there. And obviously that's Connery again in that film. But I think just to go back to the point about the reasoning behind a lot of this, I think it was a time, from what I've read about and from what I've, you know, heard about, the fact that gender roles were changing, you know, in the 1960s. You know, you were starting to see, it wasn't quite where it is obviously today, but you were starting to see more women going out and working, going out getting professional jobs. You were starting to see men feeling a little bit more like they were, you know, fulfilling what would have been previously feminine roles. And you know, the Bond films come at that sort of interesting crux point between two very different worlds, you know, the old order. And, you know, you describe Bond as like an imperialist overhang, and that's really true. You know, he really is. He's part of this very old order imperialist world with people like M and Q and all these guys who, you know, for all old war heroes and that kind of thing. And now they're facing down a world which is all about free love and the hippie movement and anti-war rhetoric and, you know, all these colourful villains who pop up. You know, you could never imagine a lot of these colourful villains existing in the 40s and 50s in the same way. Like they are resolutely, especially in the movies, they are resolute. Even though a lot of the books were written in the 50s, the movies quite often amp them up in terms of colour and, you know, spectacle and this kind of thing. And, you know, they feel very much of a time in that Fleming wrote novels and particularly Broccoli and Saltzman made films that really gave male and, to be fair, female audiences this sort of very masculine, very sort of, like you say, indefatigable in terms of sexual politics hero to fight all these colourful villains as a reaction. And I think we've got to remember that Bond, I don't think, was ever intended to be somebody who was, like you say, a predator. You know, he wasn't. I don't think that was ever the intention. I don't think you were supposed to think of Bond as, ugh, what a sleazeball. I think you were supposed to, if you were a woman, fall at his feet, really, and fancy him. And I think if you were a man, you were wanting to be him. And I think that was what they wanted to create. And I think that's what people, on the whole, I imagine that's what people felt, really, because that's why you did so well. And that's why you didn't have, at the time, too many people coming out and saying, this guy's just a dirty old lech, you know? It was, oh, Bond. A lot of these things were revised and thought about, and a lot more, you know, and sexual politics was changing heavily. And I think it's still going on today. And that's why, not to, you know, go too heavily into the modern day and what's coming up, but a lot of the rumours about Bond 25 have been that you're going to have some level of reaction to hashtag Me Too in that film. And whether or not that's going to actually be visible in that film, I don't know. But it would be fascinating to see Bond exploring that now, because the world has changed so massively.
I totally agree, because at the time of Goldfinger's release, feminist literature is taking a huge turn as well. I mean, you're getting the feminine mystique. You're getting exploration of women in the home and all that kind of stuff. What I'm really glad they dispensed with in the film is that, if I remember correctly, Pussy Galore is supposed to be a lesbian, and he sleeps with her, and then she's magically hetero. So thank God they had the taste to get that one out, you know. But as you said, Fleming is problematic himself, but Saltzman and Broccoli recognized things that were not going to be welcome, and they dispensed with them, thankfully. So, as you say, he's kind of straddling two worlds in this film. I mean, everyone's wearing a suit. I mean, they're in Kentucky and they're all wearing suits. And I'm like, God, they must be sweating buckets. You know, and also, I mean, like Felix and his CIA partner. Oh, Bond's got everything well in hand, you know, because they see him walking off with sexy Honor Blackman, you know. But yeah, also the thing that I just want to quickly pick up on what you said, Tony, is that the fact is that with this film, Bond isn't an old lich yet. I mean, Connery is still in his 30s, if I remember correctly. Mm. He's a young, strapping chap. He's got beautiful shoulders. Sorry, guys. I won't go too much into
It's true.
He does have good shoulders.
I'm sorry to say, he's a walking wet dream in this movie. I mean, his face is beautiful. No woman who is a straight woman, I don't think they're going to say no to him at this point. I think it's what happens in Never Say Never Again, as you say, in A View to a Kill, that kind of starts bringing the canon or the universe into question, where you're going, Bond's not supposed to be getting together with women who are young enough to be his daughter. It even kind of is a little bit like, you know, it's addressed in For Your Eyes Only, where, you know, there's an 18-year-old girl in his bed and he's like, no, thank you. Like, I'll buy you like an ice cream kind of thing. Even Solitaire, she's a virgin. She looks quite a lot younger than him. But it's not quite at that point yet. When it gets to A View to a Kill.
He deceives Solitaire, doesn't he? Doesn't he trick her?
Yes, when he's all the lovers and the pack and everything. So that's a little bit as well. He's not yet an old sleazeball. I don't think he's an old sleazeball, Never Say Never Again or A View to a Kill either. But as you say, the massage scene, sorry, I did a Connery thing there. that is a bit, and Kim Basinger, you know, does kind of look like she could be his daughter in that movie. So that's when it starts getting problematic, I think, with that age difference thing.
I think it's maybe starts getting problematic slightly earlier, to be fair. But, well, what I was thinking was this, actually. I think Tony made a good point about female audiences. You know, historically, Bond has had a lot of female fans too. And as much as it maybe functions as a male wish fulfillment fantasy or whatever, we shouldn't be patronising about women who, you know, lots of women don't like Bond, but lots of women do, actually. A lot of women are fans of the Bond franchise. But on the issue of it being problematic and whatnot, I think, wouldn't it be kind of damning of us as viewers if we couldn't separate these things out to a degree? I mean, we're not just empty vessels who have our heads filled with ideas that we see in old films, are we? We can kind of think for ourselves. So what I'm basically saying is I don't think it reflects badly on us as individuals if we enjoy films that do have problematic elements, you know. Mm. Although I suppose if someone podcasting about classic films, I probably would say that, wouldn't I? But in other words, what I guess I'm saying is I see no inconsistency with thinking the following things. So A, James Bond films have historically had some misogynistic elements at times.
Yeah.
B, I enjoy James Bond films a lot anyway.
Mm.
C, I don't think that makes me a misogynist. But maybe I'm in denial. I don't know. What do you reckon, Tony?
No, I agree with that. I think, as with everything, you've got to place it in the context of when it was made, in the context of the thought process behind it. You know, I think there's a big difference between, say, the process behind making a Bond film and the intentions behind making a Bond film and, say, something like the 1970s Confessions of a Window Cleaner films, for instance, you know, which are effectively softcore porn in some senses, you know, or they're designed to be, or the very late Carry On movies, you know, that are lots of bums, lots of nudity, very softcore stuff, but it's meant to titillate, specifically to titillate. I don't think Bond is doing that. I don't think it's meant, its aim is for that. I think it's got a very different kind of escapist adventure, comic book, cartoony kind of real, you know, real life mashup. You know, I think that's the point of it. So I think it's okay to like these things for the reasons you like them, because the world was very different then. And, you know, you'll get people in 50 years, there'll be films that we love today that will have elements that are problematic to people, you know, that we can't see, that we're oblivious to, or the world hasn't quite got to a point where that's a problem, whether it's sexual politics, whether it's racial, whether it's whatever, okay?
Yeah.
So I think unless it's something that's obviously patently objectionable now and was then and everyone just ignored it or pretended it wasn't there or, you know, lied about it, which I don't think was the case with Bond, I think it's fine. I think it's absolutely fine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you guys are cheering every time he acts a bit misogynistic. You know, you're not going, oh, when he slaps Dink on the bum, you know. And also the fact of the matter is, I mean, because you both highlighted that before I even had to say it. So thank you for that, gentlemen. Mm. And also the thing is that, you know, as you say, I mean, even in Goldfinger, it's called art, you know. Pussy says to him, I'm immune to the charm. you can turn it off kind of thing. You know, I'm not impressed by your little act. And he does. He changes himself accordingly. You know, he starts treating her with more respect because he goes, oh, I must be dreaming. And she's like, I am not a dream girl. Go away. And he like cottons onto that. So I think that the film addresses that in some way itself as well.
I think we should talk a bit more about the main man, you know, Sean Connery as Bond. You know, I think a lot of critics and commentators basically would say he set the gold standard for the series as Bond. It's between him and Daniel Craig for me. I think if Craig goes out on a high, he'll take the top spot in my rankings. But anyway, I think in these early films, Connery just looks so at ease in his own skin, doesn't he? It's kind of interesting considering his background, you know, born into a very poor family, worked from a very young age delivering milk and stuff like that, dropped out of school, I think, joined the Navy at age 16. Yeah. And then it's later he becomes a model, pursues acting ultimately. But just as Bond, you know, despite, you know, the hardships in his upbringing, I think of scenes like in From Russia with Love, he orders this, like, fabulously ornate breakfast at one point, you know, and he's just so convincing in his sophistication, I think. But yeah, what do you think of Connery as Bond, Tony?
I think he's great. I think, you know, he's having a lot of fun with it, you know. I think that Connery, I think, has a complicated sort of relationship with Bond in the sense, as I mentioned earlier, I think he there are aspects of this role that he struggled with, you know, and that I think there are certain films where you can feel that that he's having more fun. I want to quote from Sean Connery, a biography by Michael Friedland, in which he says, in Doctor No, the character was established. By the end of the second film, the audience had thoroughly got hold of him. After that, the interesting thing was to surprise people who thought they knew how he was going to react to a situation. You'd play the reality, play the humour, have a bit of a playful repartee with the audience and do something unexpected. So Connery at the time is talking about how he's bringing out the more fun aspects of Bond that, you know, aren't really there in the books in the same way. You know, in the books, he's a lot, I find him a lot less, you know, overtly comical. The one-liners aren't really there in the same way. You know, that's a film thing. That's a very clear delineation between the film and the books. And I think Connery in Goldfinger is having more fun than a lot of the other films. I think he's having fun up until probably about part of Thunderball and definitely by You Only Live Twice, because yeah. I think You Only Live Twice is the film he starts to lose the interest big time. And then when he comes back for Diamonds, it's contractual, really. It's just a few quid. And then I think he's not having fun again till Never Say Never Again. I think he is having fun there because it's been a while. Yeah. So it's, I think this is the one where he's sort of at his apex of enjoyment, because I think after this, he realizes that they're making the same film again. And I think that's the point he starts to go, kind of done this now.
Yeah, and I've always thought that in these early films, Gabriella, a lot of it's about his movement as well, because the films are quite slower paced, aren't they, you know, in comparison to how they change over time. Yes. And you get these scenes in the early movies where he's like walking across the hotel lobby and things, and we follow him the whole way through and stuff like that. And like I said, I said it earlier, didn't I, kind of at ease in his own skin, and that's always the kind of sense I've got from Connery in these films. So would you kind of go along with that?
I would totally agree, because Broccoli said that when he saw, they had Connery walk across the room, and they said he walked like a panther. And I totally agree with that. He looks like a predatory animal, actually, when he walks. And, sorry, speaking as a woman, it's a turn on. You're like, oh my God, he's so confident. He's so in control of himself, you know. Like, and as you say, Terence Young, as you said, who directed the first two films, he took Connery under his wing. He said Connery pitched up on set for the first day, and Terence was like, babe, we got to do something with you. Your hair's not on. He took him to his own tailor on, what's that? What's something Row, where they make all
Savile
the
Row?
That's it. He took him there to have his suit done, you know, that kind of thing. So it's just this process of refinement, as you say. And Connery, he doesn't get the sort of chops that he deserves. He's bloody good in the role. I mean, as you say, he sets the gold standard. But he is so effortless, as you said. He doesn't look like he's acting. He is Bond. He's just, I mean, I remember when I saw him for the first time when I was a child, I thought, this guy is, like, amazing. I mean, I, you know, sort of looked at my own dad, who's very masculine and very sort of dominant and stuff. And Connery reminded me of my dad. So it was sort of a psychological association as well, I suppose. But yeah, he's so in control. But at the same time, as you said, he's funny. He can be unsure of himself. He can actually be kind of tender at times. It's a very interesting portrayal. I mean, he also does that little half smile thing where you're just like, you're such a cutie kind of thing, especially when he like cracks his own joke and he's like, I think that was really funny. And I'm like, I agree with you. So yeah, he's really believable in the role. Yeah, you get to You Only Live Twice, he feels that he's not getting paid enough. I still love that movie because it's almost like his disinterest fits in with that movie. But yeah, like Tony was saying, he's having a hell of a good time in Goldfinger. And Connery is seen as being the ultimate Bond because, yes, he's a template for it. Everyone comes after him and tries to do their own thing. I think, you know, Dalton tries to return to Connery when he comes in after Roger Moore because Roger's like, the saint, the persuaders kind of Bond. And then, yeah, now Daniel Craig has sort of gone back to Timothy Dalton and Sean Connery. Because even though Sean Connery's Bond is quippy, he's funny, he's sexy, he's also deadly. I mean, he throws a woman on the floor. He lets a guy hit her on the head with a gun at the beginning of Goldfinger. You know, you're like, geez, he's not playing around. He throws a fan into a bath, a guy that gets electrocuted and dies. And he's not afraid to shoot first and ask questions later in this movie. So as much as you're laughing at his quips, you're also going, oh my God, this guy is actually an assassin. And that's what Connery really balances well.
You know what? That's something as well I think people forget about. Pretty much all of the Bonds have shown these moments, have had these moments of even in the some lighter films or films that you don't necessarily associate. You know, when people think of dark Bond films, they think of some of the Craigs or they think of, say, License to Kill, for instance, which obviously have a lot more of that. But, you know, films like you say, he's really lethal in Goldfinger, some of this stuff. You've got films like with Moore, it was For Your Eyes Only, which showed that he could actually do some of the dark stuff. You know, and also Man with the Golden Gun, where the way he manhandles Maud Adams' character in that, you know, there's a real lethality there, which you don't always see in a lot more of the comical sort of films. So, you know, it's hardwired into Bond's character, you know?
Well, it is. But Tony, come on. For Your Eyes Only ends with a parrot talking to Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, yeah. That film is wonky as hell, don't get me wrong, okay? But that moment where he kicks Locke off the cliff in that car is pure Craig Dalton Connery at his deadliest, you know? That's a dead-eyed killer, you know? And that's one of the reasons that the Craig films have really stepped it up a notch at their best is that it's really gone back to Fleming and some of that really sort of clinical blunt instrument lethality. So there are points in this where you really feel that, even though a lot of it is, you know, really fun and bouncy.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of ask you about Connery, Tony, because I think I remember you saying somewhere, I might be wrong here, but I think I remember you saying somewhere that he's probably your favourite film star.
Mm.
So I it's interesting how he ages quite dramatically during his time as Bond, doesn't he? And that's all the things we've said, he kind of has this disinterest in the role after a certain point. But he is a great movie star, isn't he? But then by the time he's older and he's doing stuff like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, there's like this resonance from his time as Bond, but he also looks so different that it feels like kind of a different guy again. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of striking how his appearance changed, I think.
It's funny because he's never really... I don't think he ever... I mean, obviously, he's long since retired now, and he's still with us as we speak. He's like 89 this year, I think. Yeah. He's doing well. So touch wood, he'll be around a while longer yet. But he's long since retired from movie making. But he never really reinvented himself as such in a way throughout that. Everything, even when he was playing diverse roles, like you say, when he played Henry Jones, where he's a bumbling old professor, you know, he's brilliant. He's really great at that with that comedy. Yes. But there are moments where by the end of that film, when he's on horseback, he's basically Bond again, right? He's kind of gone back to being much more of a suave, debonair guy who found his mojo. You know, if you look at him in the end of that film, and he always plays sort of variations on a theme in some, doesn't matter whether he's a Russian submarine. I mean, if you take away the fact he has the same accent, doesn't matter whether he's a Russian submarine commander, an American professor. That's one of the great things about. He's one of the few actors who can get away with that. But he also only ever really plays a variant on one character. And I think one of the reasons he's been, I think, underrated over the years as an actor, is that people think he's hasn't got much range. I've always disagreed with that. I think one of the things he has is a true, powerful charisma. Whether he's playing Bond or anybody else, he's magnetic when he's on screen, you know, and he can make you believe that he's all these different kind of characters, even though essentially he is just doing that weird cod Scottish sort of thing every time. So I think he is my favorite movie star, because I think he's got a rare magnetism on screen. Doesn't matter what film he's in, and I think he's never really escaped Bond in a way. There's always been that level of, and I think to some extent he brought a lot of himself into Bond. I think a lot of that was him anyway, really. A lot of that Panther walk, you know, I mean, he was a previous Mr. Universe, wasn't he, before he did Bond. He was a very masculine man. There's that great story about how he was sort of courting Lana Turner, and then she was going out with like a big mafia guy, and Connery just punches him in the face and tells him to get lost. And this is a guy who has people killed, and Connery's doesn't even blink, you know? This is like in the 50s. So there's a whole litany of the fact he was quite a tough guy in real life, I think. So I think there's a blurred line sometimes between him and Bond, and I think that's one of the reasons he does what he does.
Yeah, because I think early in his career, when he did some films with Sidney Lumet, who pushed him a bit more, maybe things like The Hill. Think you're right. After a certain time, he doesn't push himself out of his comfort zone as much. But yeah, would you go along with most of that, Gabriella?
I would, because I'm still in love with Sean Connery. I mean, he can be 115 and I'll be like, I love you so much.
It's like, you know? So.
Yeah, I mean, he is. He's a great actor. I mean, I know that, as you said, like with Highlander, for example, he's supposed to be a Spaniard and he's got a Scottish accent. I do not care. He is a Spaniard to me. It's fine,
matter.
You know?
Yeah.
Exactly, it doesn't. And he is a bloody great actor because, as you said, he is a star. You know, Connery, he's like a throwback. He reminds me of the actors who come from old Hollywood. He has this magnetism, like Joan Crawford and John Barrymore and all of these guys. He when you are watching a film he is in, you are looking at him. I mean, he's in First Night with Richard Gere, who's also a very big star. But you're not looking at Richard Gere. You're looking at Connery, who's like freaking 30 years older than Gere in that movie. And you're like, you are my Arthur. I would pledge my sword to you, like happy kind of thing. You know, and he's just, he's an absolute pleasure to watch. I never watch a Connery performance and think, oh God, this looks like so much work, you know. Like, we have to sort of sit through this.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you seen the Molly Maguires? Because that might change your mind on that one.
Oh no, I haven't seen that one. I don't want to see it now because I don't want the illusion. Yeah, I don't want the illusion to be punctured. You know, he reminds me a lot of Michael Caine. I will watch pretty much anything with Michael Caine in it, and you know, even if it's a crap movie, I'll be like, oh, I love Michael, so it's okay. It's worth it for him. I mean, like The Rock with Sean Connery in it. Not a great movie.
It is a great movie.
It's so
definitely
bad. It's
a great
good.
Movie.
You know,
Entrapment is one I like.
Yeah,
Catherine Zeta-Jones. Yeah.
I mean, Catherine Zeta-Jones is going under lasers for him. She's like humping the floor. Sorry, and Connery's just standing there going, "I do this every day," and you're like, "Yes, you do, babe. You totally do it every day."
My favorite line in that film is when he says, "I'm never late. If I'm late, it's because I'm dead." And I'm like, "Well, I mean." That's pretty, you know, has he ever tried to catch a train? Because good luck with that. You know, that's a pretty broad line.
Yeah, he must come to South Africa and try and take public transport. Yeah, people will think he's dead. Sorry.
Yeah.
But I mean, every performance, as you said, there's a rift on Bond. Because as you say, you don't know if it's Bond or if it's Connery, you know, the little smirk, the way he walks, as you said, you don't know if it's him but he just became so infused with the role, and that's fine because he's left an amazing legacy behind him. You know, I always feel it's a pleasure to watch his Bond films, even Diamonds Are Forever, which is as camp can be. And they are like, bits to it. I'm still happy to watch it. I know he's wearing a hairpiece and I don't care. It's fine.
I think to some extent as well. I think your modern equivalent of that. I would look at someone like Tom Hardy, and think of he is to some extent, I think, sort of a modern Connery, in that he will kind of, I think, always play a variant on one sort of thing, but he has a lot of on screen charisma. But it's rare. It is rare these days.
It's very rare.
So I just wanted to pick up a bit more on some of these stylistic traits of the film and the series generally. I think they're very important to me as a Bond fan. So for me, the most exciting moment for me as a Bond fan is just being sat in the cinema waiting for the new Bond film to start. That moment when you're waiting for the gun barrel sequence that usually kicks them off. Of course, not all the Craig films have had them at the outset, but it's at that moment, you don't know if you're going to get a Skyfall or a Dying of a Day, but it's a moment where anything seems possible, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's all that. When you first get the music blasting at you, it's a very special feeling, I think. And so it's the music's a huge part of the appeal. We've already talked about, you know, the theme songs, also the elements like the very stylized title sequences we get. But they're all important parts of the brew, aren't they, Tony, I think? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, there was the big whole thing with Daniel Craig's films in that we've had to wait until Spectre, his fourth film, to properly get a gun barrel. And, you know, I mean, that's rubbish. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not, the gun barrel at the end is not the same, you know, and this is the whole thing about the formula. They fell into that. I mean, if you look at Dr. No, that was specifically sort of designed as part of the electronic Monty Norman stuff that they were doing. And it wasn't, I think, ever meant to sort of stick, but it kind of did. And then it became this real sort of part of the legend and the lore of, and the uniqueness of Bond. And a lot of these things, they just sort of fall into them, you know. A lot of the scenes, I think, part of the actual formula, you know, like the gadgets, the scene with the gadgets where you go to Q and he gives you all the gadgets, you know. Those are the things that in the modern films, when Bond has tried to steer a little bit away from that, people have gone, oh, hang on, that's what we want though. That's why we watch these films, you know. And that's, you know, and again, it all goes back to the way a lot of these things are filmed, in that they haven't remade exactly the same kind of shots and things like that, but there are certain aspects to Bond that you just kind of expect, you know. I mean, I got so excited when in Skyfall we got the old office back, you know,
yeah.
with the pneumatic cushions, sort of cushions, yeah, on it, and I was like, oh my god, that's amazing! Like, I was so happy with that. Because there is a visual language to them that in the old 60s films that has always sort of stayed with the franchise. And I think that's part of the charm. You know, that's part of the joy of it, really.
So, I mean, for me, I actually think I agree with what you say. And I think Skyfall is actually my favourite Bond film, perhaps controversially. But it's because of what you say. It delivers the formula, but it's also bending it and subverting it to a large degree. So you've got M is in the Bond girl type role, you know, in that film. We're accustomed, the villain normally has these big lairs, but the equivalent in Skyfall is Bond's childhood home, you know. Like you say, it brings back the old status quo in a way that feels earned, I thought. And the whole thing where he has this figurative death and rebirth, I think, works really well there. But I don't know, I guess, Gabriella, the series has a tendency at times, you know, a detractor might say, to become a bit bloated, spectacle for spectacle's sake. Yeah. And it's often reflected in things like the pre-credit sequences, isn't it? So in Goldfinger, we get a nice kind of taut one, don't we?
Yeah.
But you think of the way the series gravitates to, I guess, one of the most absurd ones. It's a good sequence in its own right, but something like The World Is Not Enough is like an absurdly long pre-credit sequence. It often feels like, to me anyway. Do you know what I mean? And I don't know, does the series have, like I say, a tendency to get bloated? Is that kind of the pitfall they fall into?
You know, I like the long pre-title sequence, so I'm probably not the best person to talk to about this. But I mean, what I love about Goldfinger is that, yeah, you see him like snorkeling, you're like, is that Bond, is it not? You know, I'm trying to take myself back to being a viewer of Goldfinger, like when it came out, and I don't think I would have immediately thought it was Bond, because it's not really established yet, you know. And then, as you say, he's on another mission, he's wearing his like tuxedo, which is under his wetsuit, which is perfectly dry. I mean, I just love that. It just makes me so happy. But I think that's what makes Bond, the pre-title sequences. I mean, like in Spectre. Okay, Spectre's not a great Bond film. It's one of the weaker entries. It's still enjoyable, not great though. But you know, when he's in Mexico City and, you know, you don't immediately see him, and then he's walking through the streets in the day of the on the Day of the Dead, and it's like really good. And I can live and let die when, you know, the guy says, whose funeral is it? And the guy says, it's yours. And then they drop the coffin and they take him in, and then it's the big parade. I think that's what makes Bond. If you don't have a big title sequence which really grabs you, you know, then just go and see another movie that's, you know, sort of playing in the next, you know, go and see a Marvel movie or something, because they've tried to sort of imitate that, but they don't quite have the same magic. The World Is Not Enough is a bit long, but it has a good payoff at the end where, you know, he falls and he breaks his arm and all that kind of stuff, and you feel like you feel like it's been earned. You're like, okay, it's got a satisfying ending to it. I've never watched a pre-title sequence in a Bond film and thought, God, you know, what was that for? I'm like, oh my God, I want to see what's going to happen next. Then you go into the title sequences and you're like, beautiful, like, you know, you've got beautiful women doing weird stuff, but somehow it makes sense because it's Bond. You know, I mean, like, who, what women are going to be covered in gold and have projection thing? And those poor women must have been blinking like mad after that. But it's awesome. You know, I love it. It's, yeah.
Yeah. I think in the specific case of The World Is Not Enough, the last time I watched that film, it just seemed to me that the later action sequences are nowhere near as compelling as that first one.
Yeah.
So it kind of feels like the film's a bit unbalanced is kind of what I was thinking, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, Tony, you mentioned at the outset, which I thought was interesting, about maybe it needs to become this universe. So either that means more Bond films more quickly, or they develop some of these characters, don't they, like M and Q and Moneypenny. And that's kind of interesting that someone like Goldfinger, I mean, they cast them all really well early on, didn't they? So Bernard Lee, Lois Maxwell, Desmond Llewellyn. Mm. They own those roles, I think. And I think those are the people you think of when you say M or Q or Moneypenny. I suppose Judi Dench probably comes close now for a lot of people. But they tended to have quite functional, perfunctory roles in these early films, didn't they? Just a scene here or a scene there. Like we've sort of said in Skyfall and Spectre, they seem to be more of a unit now, kind of a Scooby Gang thing. They're a bit more integral. But you think maybe they can get some mileage out of amplifying the roles of these characters. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I think it depends how you do it, really. And I think I say this, that maybe is the best move for them. I'm not sure it's the right move. And I don't know is the honest truth. It could be spectacularly the wrong move. But I think in terms of the way cinema is going right now, it could help the Bond franchise. Whether it is a good idea, I don't know. It depends how you approach it. I think you've got to make sure, obviously, that Bond is the center point of everything. I think, to be honest, I think the first thing they should do really, before necessarily having lots of spin-off kind of things, is that they really go for a Bond era that is very much a series of interconnected movies, that you have essentially a six-part story and you have it play out over six movies, you know, and you do that kind of thing. And I think that, and they, because they've never really engaged with that level of depth and continuity. So I think it would be great to actually see that first and foremost. And then whether you can spin off characters, I think the danger of having a starting point of let's then do a Moneypenny film or go back and do an M prequel, I think you're in danger of potentially crafting something that isn't really, there's no point to it. I mean, I always remember how they originally planned to have the character of Jinx played by Halle Berry. Yeah. To get her own movie after Die Another Day. And after Die Another Day was a catastrophic failure, they jinxed that. But they got rid of it. But I don't necessarily think that would have been a bad movie if you'd have done it right. You know, the idea was to take that character and give her own, you know, her own movie in the NSA and all this kind of thing. And I don't necessarily think that would have been bad. But I think you had to get that right in the first place. You had to get the original film right in order to spin that off properly. So I think it would depend how they approached it, who it was with. I mean, you could, in theory, create a Moneypenny who was... I mean, Naomi Harris is close to it, but you could really create a Moneypenny from the ground up who is capable of going off and doing her own kind of missions and having a very different sort of... similar to Bond, but not quite the same movie, and do that alongside it. In theory, you could, but you've got to really think it through. And I think it would be better to make that an organic thing as opposed to a, here's the Bond cinematic universe. This year it's Bond. Next year it's Moneypenny. Year after it's it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I think there might be a fair few Bond fans out there who kind of want something different, in that they probably just want these isolated, self-contained adventures. Let's have, you know, a pre-credit sequence that doesn't tally up with the rest of the plot and things like that. I don't know. Where do you stand, Gabriella?
I'm one of those fans.
Yeah, I thought you might be.
I'm getting bogged down in the backstory. I thought they should have just finished it with Skyfall and then he just carried on. Why does Blofeld have to be his half-brother? Sorry if that's spoilers for anyone. I mean,
that's okay.
Like, you know, it's just for me, I'm just like, I want him to go on a mission. I want there to be a madman. I want him to kick the madman's butt. I want there to be an interesting Bond girl. I want there to be a nice, upbeat sort of Bond title song. I love Skyfall. Spectre is also pretty good, but we've had enough of the ballads now. I want a sort of Duran Duran, A View to a Kill, jivey kind of Bond song. Yeah, I mean, you can do a cinematic universe, cool, fine, whatever, But I don't know. I don't think you should get too much into M's backstory or Q's backstory or Moneypenny's backstory. That's what I always loved about Lois Maxwell's Moneypenny, is she was just like there, you know? And she always, like, you always liked her so much because she had this flirtation going on with Bond. But I didn't have to see what she went, like, if she went home to her husband or something like that, you know? That kind of thing doesn't interest me. Maybe I sound like a terrible, shallow person. I like to think that Q goes home to, like, a Batman lair and he has all these gadgets. That's fine. But that's my mind. I don't know if I actually want to see that playing out on the screen, you know? I think because I'm an old school Bond fan, even though I was born, you know, in the late 20th century, I love my favorite Bond films are him going on a mission. And also the thing we have to remember is that Bond is a spy. He's not really supposed to make super personal associations and have lots of friends and stuff. I mean, that's going to start jeopardizing his 00 status. So you've got to really be careful with that, you know? I think Spectre, with that whole thing where she's like, I love you and everything, I was a bit like, you know, move along. As I said, I probably sound like a terrible, shallow person. But yeah, I just love, like, I think that's why License to Kill is one of my favorite, is probably my favorite one. Because he has a friend in Felix. Felix gets his leg chomped off. He's like, I'm pissed off about this. I'm going after Sanchez. I'm like, you go, yay. And then that's it, you know?
Yeah, because I think some of the so-called purists would say Bond doesn't really need much of, in the way of an interior life. It's like you're saying, you know, it doesn't really need to be that rounded a character. He functions better as a type or an archetype. So maybe the fact that Connery is still held up by a lot of people as the benchmark might indicate there's something to that. But to go back to what Tony was saying, I think I don't have an issue with a continuing through line in terms of plotting and things. I just don't want them to pull it out of the hat like they did with Spectre, where it's too transparently a retcon, isn't it? I think is the big issue there.
They're like, oh, look, he suddenly, you know, he was the cuckoo in the nest, as Blofeld says. And you're like, where did this come from now? I mean, they can do a through plot, but they have to do, as like Tony said, they have to get that core story right. They have to make it interesting. Mm-hmm. They have to have a really strong through story, as you say. Not just be like, oh, maybe we can try this and people will like it. No. Yeah. Please don't do that.
They've got to commit to it. And what they tried to do with Spectre was retroactively go back and link it all up because they wanted some level of, you know, continuity with it all. And they were trying to appease, you know, the growing number of people who are interested in these cinematic universes and continuity and all this kind of thing. But you can't do it arse about face, for want of a better term. You know, and that's exactly what stymied the DC cinematic universe, you know, with Batman and Superman and all that kind of thing, because they went into it backwards. And it doesn't really work. You've got to know where you're going. You've got to have a rough idea. So if they either go down that route and they map it out properly and they know where they're going to hit over a 10-year period. Or, like you said, Gabriella, they stick to the one film at a time and they do it and they don't worry about that. And do you know what? That might well be the better way. I mean, I'm saying all this. I don't necessarily think it might be right for Bond. I wouldn't mind seeing them try, I suppose. Yeah, and then if it doesn't work, go back to the way it used to be, maybe.
Before we like wrap up and stuff, I think that because Gabriella said you want to see a madman and all this, so maybe just a quick word on Gert Frobe as Goldfinger and Harold Sakata as Oddjob. You know, because I think Goldfinger is a classic Bond villain. You know, the typical he's like this non-state sanctioned operative intent on amassing all this power, world domination. But I like the battle of wits between the villains and Bond that you get in the books, especially, and in the films. But in the books where, you know, something like Casino Royale, a lot of that book is devoted to him playing cards, you know, and it's the same in Moonraker. I think he's playing bridge with Drax. And there's a satisfying amount of that in the film too, I think. You know, Goldfinger cheating on cards early on, the golf match, all that stuff. Also that scene, I love it, where Goldfinger just can't resist but outlining this plan to Bond, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people have parodied it now. You know, Austin Powers, of course, being a very funny, it's a brilliant parody, that first one. And people go, oh, you know, now we're going to have the villain outline his plan, blah, blah, blah. But these villains are megalomaniacs, as you say. They want to say to Bond, haha, look, I've outwitted you, I've outwitted your stupid government, you know, your silly queen, your prime minister, your M, you know, because they know about all of these people. And obviously they're going to boast about it because they are like psychopathic weirdos. I mean, even Silver does it in Scarfall, which is great. You know, when he says, you know, you touch a button and, you know, everything's gone. And I love that part with Goldfinger explaining it to him. For me, I always had this sort of backstory in my brain about Goldfinger that he had Nazi ties. That, you know, that's why he's so interested in that bar of gold that's supposed to have Nazi ties. Because I can imagine him, he says that he's British, but he doesn't have a British accent. I feel like he sort of doctored his papers to make it sound like he's British, you know, through documentation, but he's actually like an escaped Nazi or something like that. That's what I always sort of thought he probably was. And yeah, he's got this delicious, terrible villainy to him. He's a coward when it comes to the crunch. And Oddjob is so devoted to the cause that he kills that other guy so that he can't stop the bomb. You're like, wow, dude, this is really like going a bit far, you know? I mean, like Goldfinger's run off in his outfit and Oddjob's still hanging around. I mean, meh, but yeah, it's and then Goldfinger appears on the plane and he's like, oh, Mr. Bond, you know, I'm going to get rid of you. And then he gets sucked through a window. I mean, that's a great villain death. It's totally unrealistic, but I'm like, get sucked through the window into outer space, you know?
Playing his golden harp.
Yeah. Yes, I love that.
Yeah, and Tony, I think in Oddjob, you know, I guess alongside Richard Kiel's Jaws, you'd probably hold him up as the most memorable henchman in the series too, you know? So, yeah, what do you make of both these figures?
I think they're really fun, you know, and I think they are sort of part of the archetypal sort of Bond villain figures. I mean, you know, you can look at, I think really if you boil the essence down of the Bond bad guy, you can sort of fuse together Dr. No's sort of urbane, you know, clinical evil with Goldfinger's largesse, you know, that kind of mix of the two. And then, yeah, I think your ultimate two sort of henchmen are Oddjob and Jaws. They're the pure sort of monolithic slabs of, you know, lethality. And Oddjob, obviously, the fun thing with Oddjob is that he's this big guy with the bowler hat and this incongruous look between the English gentleman, you know, caddying golf clubs for this, you know, industrialist, with the fact that, you know, you've got an actor like Harold Sakata, who was an Olympic wrestler, you know, and you've got that kind of, you know, almost mute sort of character. So, and again, they've just replicated this. I mean, in many ways, I tend to think that Spectre's henchman Hinks, played by Dave Bautista, is basically Oddjob. It's like a new Oddjob, really. So they've sort of replicated these guys over the years. But, you know, largely, bar one or two exceptions, nobody does it better, really, for bad guys. Yeah. And sorry, I had to get that in there.
Yeah, good stuff.
All right, I just wanted to read a few listener comments out before we go. So Dustin, who's at BookBabble on Twitter, said, Goldfinger is one of my all-time favourites. Both the book and the film are phenomenal. Did you know that Anthony Horowitz helped finish a sequel to Goldfinger? It's called Trigger Mortis and came out in 2015. Pussy Galore returns in the book. Yeah, which I read when it came out. That's good fun.
This blew my mind, though. I didn't realise this till the other day, and I found this out. And I had no idea that Trigger... I've got it on my shelf. I haven't read it yet. I had no idea it was a sequel to Goldfinger. That's amazing.
Yeah. Have you read it, Gabriella?
No, I haven't even heard of it. God, I'm so sorry. I'm a bit behind on the Bond continuation novels, because there's a few that I've read where I'm like, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was one that I read where, like, he spent like a page talking about a Bond girl's boobs, and I was like, so they sort of vary in quality, but if he says that it's good, I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, I remember it being fun, and I've just picked up, Horowitz has just written another one. I think it's called Forever and a Day. Literally just bought it today.
Yeah, I was gifted that recently. I haven't read it yet, but yeah, he's a really good writer. If you've ever read The Taste of Silk, that he's Sherlock Holmes' novel, that's a cracking read. So he's a really good escapism writer.
Yeah.
That's him. Okay, I've read that one. Yeah. Okay, no, then I'll definitely go and look for it. Yeah, that's good.
Okay, so Erica D said, I especially love the John Barry soundtrack, which is haunting yet not too dark. All the villain cast is perfect, and Pussy Galore is a top Bond girl. Really, I must be dreaming.
I must be dreaming.
And finally, Tim O'Brien finally says, the best Bond by a country mile, and it has the Crane family song as its theme. What more can you ask? So what he's referring to there, for anyone who doesn't know, is an episode of Frasier where Frasier and Niles and their father all sing Goldfinger, I think. So it's on YouTube.
Yeah, I just remembered that now.
Yeah, that's a great scene. I love that.
I forgot about that.
All right, so yeah, Commander Black, Commander Masson, This has been a lot of fun. I think we'll have to do something for Bond 25. We'll put our heads together nearer at a time. We'll find a way to come back and do something. But yeah, before we go, tell us about what you're up to online. So Tony, you can go first.
Well, I've got my main place to find me, I guess, is on Twitter at AJBlackWriter. I have my website where I'm writing about various different things. Right now, I'm writing about the X-Men movies. Whether or not that will still be the case when this goes out, I don't know. But it's called theculturalconversation.com. I am also writing about Bond. I've done Dr. No from Russia with Love will be coming soon as well. So I'm going through it steadily, as I mentioned earlier. Also, if you're interested in more podcasting, then come over to We Made This, which you type that into Google, you'll find it, which is the podcast network Carl is heavily involved in as well, with the X-Cast, which is our X-Files podcast, and The Time Is Now, which is our Millennium podcast. So come over there. There's loads more as well, loads of other podcasts. Come over and check us out and see what we're up to.
Great stuff, Tony. Can't wait till the next time we talk on the podcast somewhere. It's 100%. Always good fun.
Yeah.
How about you, Gabriella? What are you up to?
Okay, well, you can find me on Twitter as Noir or Never. There's underscores between, so it's Noir underscore or underscore Never. I always have to explain that to people because they're like, I can't find you. And I'm like, underscores are important. and then I've got a blog. It's PaleWriter2 on WordPress. And I mostly cover classic films. I've got two series running at the moment, which I'm horribly behind on, but I'm gonna get on top of that now. One is dedicated to Alan Ladd, so it's Adventures in Alan. I mean, you know, Carl, you follow me on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Alan's my man. You know,
is he more of a walking wet dream than Sean Connery? Would you say?
Carl, don't ask me these impossible questions. I don't have clear answers for you. I'm so sorry. Okay. Yes. And then the other one is The Look, where I recreate classic makeup looks. So, like, hopefully I'm going to be doing Audrey Hepburn soon. I even bought the eyelashes. So watch out for that one. Yeah. Hopefully I'll be able to see still. But I'll let you guys know when I do it. And then I've got another project that I'm working on with someone who I really admire. I've already told you guys about it off air, but I can't say too much about it now. But I'm very excited about it, and just like watch out on my Twitter feed and my blog and stuff. I should hopefully in the next few months be dropping hints about that and announcing what's going on. I sound very mysterious. I sound like sort of a James Bond villain myself right now. But yeah, it's something to be excited about. I really hope a lot of what I can say right now is it's something to do with classic films. Surprise, surprise. So yeah, hopefully everyone will like what I'm working on. So yeah, but come on over, chat to me on Twitter, chat to me on my blog. You know, I host blogathons and stuff as well. So if you're a blog writer and you love old films, even if you don't love old films, just come over and I can make you love old films. Yeah.
I'm excited to see how your plans for world domination pan out, I must say. So
thank you.
Watch this space, I guess, guys.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you can find Movie Palace in all the usual places. So come and talk to us on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, also on Facebook and Instagram. But yeah, I hope you can join us next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace. If you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Palace and you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can buy me a cup of coffee via the Ko-fi website. Go to ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. That's ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. CarlSweeney. Thank you. The Movie Palace will return.